there is a work that has been done that has been reported in this process already, the Division of Revenue Bureau, that was reviewing the contracts in terms of the municipal infrastructure funds. And that work, obviously the fruits of that we can only see going forward. So, but I think it's important for the committee and parliament in general to be able to monitor what is actually happening there. Part of the challenge is the absorptive capacity, I suppose, of certain municipalities. And there is this institution called the Municipal Infrastructure Support Agency. Is it called an agent now? That was established to assist some of those municipalities that are failing to absorb the resources that have been allocated to them. And I think it's important that some conversations do take place with that agent as well during the course of the year to see that we can improve the absorptive capacity of municipalities as far as infrastructure grant spending is concerned. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Let's conclude with Salka before we go back to members.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good to all the members. I think the Chairperson of the ASU alluded exactly on the presentation that Cindy Wazengwa delivered on the 2nd of March on behalf of SALGA. The main four issues that came out of the presentation is the cost of three basic services in respect to the equitable share allocation that we think is understated. And then the equitable share allocation, the institutional capacity as well, which causes quite the problems for municipalities. The other one that, again, the Chairperson has alluded on is the significant increase, one of them, on the ESCOM in relation to the budget control of the municipality. The consequences of that, they even go to an extent of the question rate. So it has dire implication to the municipality. The government debt as well, it's one that you hope that's a challenge that we shouldn't be experiencing, considering that we all 3 years government, we shouldn't be having those challenges without wasting your time, Chairperson. I think that our presentation that we divide on the second was quite in detail, and the highlights of it is exactly what the Chairperson of the FFC was alluding on.
Okay, thank you very much. Honorable members, your turn. Honorable Aikiman, Honorable Fick, Honorable Machopa. Yes. Honorable Aikiman.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the thank you for the presentation. Let me thank Treasury, FFC, SALGA, and the Equal Education. I'm just going to start lastly at first of all, with the financial first of all. I think what you're saying is very, very important. With the amount of money that is spent on compensation to employees and directors and deputy directors and CEOs and things, the amount of money that gets and the outputs from the money that we spend is doesn't happen. So that seems to be a great actual challenge to us. In terms of SALGA, I think, you know, I know you're asking for money when you believe it should go to you. But the problem is you're not spending what you're getting right now, but you want more. That's the problem. I think that's what needs to be addressed. Very much. With equal education, maybe you should tell us with regards to the issue of transport, where do you think it should fall under? Because usually it's transport rates should fall under basic education. My personal view is that maybe it should fall under basic education, since it is affecting learners at least. But what I want to know is, given the complex situation we sit with in terms of learners having in rural areas, having, is there nothing else we could do to educate these learners, you know, with high cost of transport, with the amount of travel, the risk of that? And when I say that, I'm asking whether we should not be looking at something like, you know, private tuition to some of the learners, whether there's some more viable, you know, to learners in certain areas instead of making excessive costs in terms of traveling. What I find that you don't seem to emphasize is the quality of education. because, you know, we've done some oversight of this, especially for Eastern Cape. I haven't seen any quality inspection that we have.
Can you not hear me?
In the oversight list that we've done, especially like to the Eastern Cape, I can tell you we're not impressed with what we saw at the schools. Even at the new schools that the CD is busy with and things like that, there were no sports facilities. The nutrition centers were a problem. You're expecting the kids, the minister emphasizing health. The water is right down. No kid is going to go there, but you're providing them nutrition. That was the problem. Boys and girls are using the same toilet facilities with no closed doors. How they're doing that, we don't know. An excuse they gave us in terms of the sports facility, the terrain is and slope, and I wanted to know why didn't you build it 200 meters away that an exercise game, they couldn't answer that. Schools were standing, two schools were being by one contractor, 82 million, 78 million, both are standing contractor, having a great time standing in his blood officers. You know, so those are the problems. But even in terms of the educators, as you're not putting emphasis on anybody to make sure that the quality of educators, you can put this from my understanding what we are doing in the Eastern Cape especially. We are converting mud schools to big schools. That's all, nothing more. We are not improving the quality of education in those places. You know, we've met educators, we've met deputy principals, we've met principals, I'm telling you, we're just not impressed. You're putting a science laboratory, and yet the temperature is high, and you can put chemicals in it. And they say, no, it's fine, and you know the temperature is these days. That is the kind of thing. So I don't know, I think you need to also emphasize that we need to take quality education if we want to up to standard, and if we want these kids to really deliver at some stage and become professionals, then we must from now ensure that they're getting that quality education. So for me, it seems to be a problem, and I would like you to pay little bit more attention. This question that I'm going to ask, the problems that you seem to experience, okay, before you go, in the head of the provinces, can you give us the challenges in terms of transport? Which are the provinces that are having a major problem in terms of that? And also the schools that were built, that were converted from mud schools to that, I think there were 500 and something that we were supposed to do, and we've only done 130 something. Especially in the Eastern Cape, because that's what we mentioned, visited some of those schools. We found that building those schools didn't really make much of a difference, because learners still had to travel long distances to even get to that school. So I'm not sure whether the schools are really being located in the ideal, you know, area or to attract those learners. So for me, that was really a concern. Also remember, I don't see you talking too much about nutrition. And why I'm bringing nutrition into this, no child sitting in that class is going to do justice if that child is not fed. Already these children are traveling long distances, they're walking, they're putting themselves at risk and everything else. But when they're going hungry to that school, the children are not going to be able. So if you could just put some emphasis on even on the nutrition programs for these schools to ensure that happens. We have a very high unemployment rate in the country. We have a very high unemployment rate. And we have learners that are excelling in math and science and all these subjects. They don't have jobs. And that's why I was saying that if we could provide some kind of different education to these learners in those rural areas, okay, by using the expertise and knowledge of these ones themselves, by employing them, and letting them go out into those areas and providing, because they will also be getting experience, they'll be getting knowledge, they'll be educating our learners, and cut down the transport costs, and you'll give them better quality education. So I would love if you would perhaps, you know, respond to that point. And I want you to tell me whether you think a CD itself, whether it's really working. You know, because now we're talking about there's going to be a merger in terms of that, and I know you're saying that it's going to affect you in a negative. And I'm not sure, because the city themselves has not been performing, so if they're not performing in a merger, maybe it would be a good thing. But in your presentation, you are saying that it is going to have a negative impact. So maybe you need to elaborate. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you for the presentations. Very good. I was very impressed with the equal education presentation. If you don't get the money, then
there must be something wrong with treasury. So I'm hoping that they listen to you. See, I just have one question. With regards to the moving of the central procurement office to centralizing that, is there any major change in the division of revenue for? Thank you.
Honorable Matopa.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank for the presentation for equalization. I think we are really taking the matters of our communities that are really affecting them. I want to check in terms of school infrastructure, which offices are not prioritizing the eradication of school infrastructure paid off from their exhibitions? Does equal education have information about the performance of each province in this regard? And which province has and which province seem to be performing better in terms of using their equitable shares to eradicate good infrastructure backlog? That is a question that I have. I'm asking this question based on the fact that the FFC has correctly indicated that in most provinces and in local municipalities, there is a high under expenditure in regard to infrastructure. Hence, we are saying there is a cut. But to have an information which are those that are doing best and those that are not utilizing the opportunity of these budgets and expenditure, because the cut, as the FFC has correctly indicated, is based on that, because you can't keep on pumping money that is not being utilized. Maybe it will assist us if the FFC does understand to say that these provinces have spent so much in regard to the infrastructure, or as in the KTX. And the other question is based on the, I want to ask the chair, the CEO of FFC. You have indicated the formula to say, I think you are correct to say that when you lose the people, you lose the money. That's what you said. But for equitable share to be determined based only on population, I don't think it will be correct. Don't you think that if the formula would be based also on the backlog of service delivery, in particular in the basic needs, as we have indicated that it's enshrined in the Constitution that it's the right for the citizens, you know, to get water, to get electricity, sanitation. If now our formula is only to be based on population, don't you think that it's not going to really cover or address the challenge that is envisaged in the Constitution for the basic needs? Maybe when you look at the formula, one will suggest that maybe in future, if you can investigate further on that regard to see the backlog in the areas, because you may find that Eastern Cape, to cite an example, in KwaZulu-Natal, as the Equal Education were doing their presentation, saying that they are under Gauteng. Gauteng is a gold province, which means to say everybody will move to there, but it's not that they are going to say they are there for the work, but they will open to Eastern Cape. And you don't look at the backlog. You look at the population. Maybe it's better to balance the two when you allocate this thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mine is directed to finance and the CEO. Now, in regards to the demarcation board, you know, we are hearing some complaints that the work that they have done was not correct. What I wanted to find, were you consulted with regards to this new demarcation that are going to take place in the new election?
Okay. I just wanted to comment on one issue, which the FFC CEO and Chairperson raised. The offer for a confederation within yourselves and open education. If you could also look at the issue of eradicating bad school infrastructure, together with the imperative to build new infrastructure, because there's a growing number of children going into the education system. And you see that because the growing number also of the learners going out through the matrix system into the tertiary or into the labor force is growing. So what then would be the balance between the two? But I think that also links up with the issue you raised, that of demographics, the urban rural mobility. To what extent and how far is it affected? Both. If you could look into that area as well when you do have your conversation, and I hope it will be soon. Education. Yes. Let's allow for responses. Equal education first.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just with regards to the questions around transport and with regards to teacher quality, Equal Education is of course very concerned with the quality of education that learners get in our engaging with the DBE or seeks to engage with the DBE quite readily around teacher training, around what type of engagements they are doing. One also has to remember that the main provider of teacher education, further training of teachers, are based with the different departments. So where one's engagement to improve teacher quality, it would be on a provincial level, and the provincial government is essentially the one that needs to be held accountable when that is not happening. With regards to scholar transport, I would agree with the Honourable Member that the constitutional duty for providing scholar transport rests with the Department of Basic Education. Obviously, the Department of Transport, with their intimate knowledge with regards to the public transport system and those types of things, would definitely play a role there. But I would agree that that is where the duty lies. When we talk about transport in the rural setting, is that what we find in when you talk about why incur the what could be massive costs in transferring learners to schools, the inverse of that is if one moves the school to where the learner is, for instance, you do get schools that are so small that they become educationally non-viable. You have a village of, for instance, of 100 learners that are spread across the grade, but according to the post-provisioning model of the DBE, a school like that would only qualify for 3 teachers. Then you will have multi-level teaching, multi-grade teaching. Why you have transport is because it's a cost-effective way of taking the learners to a school. Or it could be cost-effective if it's implemented properly. What also happens is there's also benefit of a learner being in a school setting, being with his or her peers, learning social skills from each other and developing as a person like that, as opposed to sitting at home perhaps and homeschooling in a different sort of way. So that is one thing that we feel is a benefit of being in a school setting. When we talk about scholar transport and you talk about smaller schools and those types of things, one of the means that departments are using to address this type of matter is through rationalization. It's happening in the Free State, it's happened in the Free State, and it also happens it's now happening in the Eastern Cape with its intention to close 2,000 small to medium-sized schools. They have a sort of criteria in which they identify these schools, and they're moving them to bigger schools with boarding facilities that then you don't incur the cost of having to transport them daily back in from school. The schools that we've engaged are schools that are a little bit bigger. For instance, one school that I'll mention is Mangeni. That's a school situated in KwaZulu-Natal. That school has over 400 learners. A little over 260 require transport. The department, after many responses and even a march to the provincial office in Pietermaritzburg, eventually provided the school with 3 buses. One of the issues you do find, and this is not necessarily with Mangeni because it hasn't happened there, hopefully it won't happen there, is the fact that
government departments, because they are their funding is so is limited, is that sometimes service providers are not being paid. Then they unilaterally stop the service, and then the child or the learner is then left without. That can obviously be addressed by if you have a situation of rationalization, but that also you have to have a whole host of other issues that will come into play with that. It would be taking the learner away from their home, from their support structure. Also, in the more rural settings, learners also have familial responsibilities in the afternoons. From what we can find is that transport will present an effective and an efficient way of getting learners to schools, provided that the National Department of Transport, the DBE and Treasury come up, they sit down, have these guidelines and norms that the lady was alluding to, and that they then, if a conditional grant is the best answer for it in the long term, that they do that. But those are just one of the two things that I just wanted to mention. One form of addressing it could be rationalization, but we also have our reservations about that. And secondly, transport is a cost-effective way, provided that there is adequate funding and that proper budgeting occurs. I hope that answers your question in part, at least on directed towards me. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Fig. Sorry, Gamal, I'm going to address your question. Firstly, on is OCD working? We think not, because initially OCD was a 3-year plan, became a 5-year plan, became a 6-year plan. 510 schools, 134 schools actually delivered. And then the conflicting or contradicting figures that we're getting from the DDE is that in January 26, I think they had a presentation to the portfolio committee where they had figures that they released of in the second quarter last year, they had built 129 schools at SE, and in the third term, they had an additional 134 schools. But when you look at the website and you look at the actual schools, there's not an accumulation. It is an overall 134. So firstly, the DBE is not presenting the figures correctly. They're not giving us the information we need, because if the information was correct, we wouldn't be hounding DBE over and over. And in terms of the Lady from Finance indicated that a city was always going to be merged with EIG, and that a city will become the responsibility of the province. Now, if you look at the departments like the Eastern Cape, where this is the state of their fund, they only use this as a prison of the fund, they're underspending by 600 million rand in 1 year. How do you now trust them further with another grant on top of that? So we just have clarity on that. Like, if provinces aren't performing under the current model, how can you now give them more responsibility and the true grants to actually deliver? And then Honourable with regards to the actual figures on how provinces perform and then allocate the ES to infrastructure. KZN, Gauteng and Western Cape are the best in terms of last year's figures, where they provided approximately 1.67%, 1.76% and 1.2% respectively of the equal football share to school infrastructure. The worst opportunity is Eastern Cape, Limpopo and Mpumalanga, where Eastern Cape only provided 0.22%. And then next, for this year, they're going to only provide the 0.05% of equal share, right? And then next year, they're not going to provide money. So this is their 3-year plan that we saw last year, where as time progresses, each province actually decreasing the amount of money they are contributing towards school infrastructure from their own equitable share. And with regards to housing, there was a slight increase actually to 2.26%, which is welcome. But once again, maybe it is addressing the migration to housing from a lot of families, and then it's addressing the new schools. But also in a high-level manner, the provinces that are actually performing are the provinces that are actually giving more of their equitable share towards school infrastructure. And your name from SSC, you mentioned that there is a manner of actually ring-fencing equitable share and directed towards certain projects and certain programs. So I hope I didn't hear it incorrectly. And if that is correct, would that be a plan or something that you would see for infrastructure as well? Not necessarily municipality only, but school infrastructure. Thank you. I hope I've answered your question. Thank you.
So
just to add also on with regards to your question around which are the worst performing provinces when it comes to scholar transport also, it is you find your more rural provinces, but as I explained with regards to even your more developed provinces like Gauteng and the Western Cape, where they say in the Western Cape almost in the entire or transports more, transport all the learners that require transport. But as you would remember, I pointed out in my presentation how they come about this data. The policy currently allows for a principal to make application to the DBE. The DBE identifies learners. This is now in terms of provincial policies. The DBE identifies, or the provincial education department identifies the learners, and that list that is given to transport or to the or the department or the education department itself then devises a transport plan. So that is how they have come to know about this. But through our engagements with principals, both in the Eastern Cape, both and in KwaZulu-Natal, where we focus on this problem, is that principals have provided, they have continually provided or made applications to provincial departments. They would then get no acknowledgement of receipt or any answer from them, and then they stop replying. There's a principal who said he's been applying for more than 10 years, his children doesn't get transport, so he has just stopped applying for transport. Whether the school, whether the department takes those old applications into account, whether they've adjudicated or whether they've considered those applications, one also does not know. A spokesperson for the KwaZulu-Natal Education Department recently said, or last year said, that for them to transport all the learners in the province that require transport, they would need an excess of 2 billion rand. The current transport budget for, if you look at it, the entire country is just a little over 2 billion rand. So one has to, if just going on their own numbers, there's very numbers that they are presenting before Parliament, putting out in the media, and that is what I'll call for adequate data capturing and adequate identification of beneficiaries. We are also thankful to Treasury and the other departments that are willing to meet with us and engage with us on this issue, and we would, as the chairperson said, would look to do that very quickly so that we can sort of come to an understanding or see whether we can make helpful submissions in formulating a plan, an action plan around this. Thank you.
Okay.
You know, we're talking about these boarding schools. There's now an added problem in terms of that, and I'm going to give you an example of Mandela Park in the Eastern Cape with Sitsikama. Those kids have to be now accommodated at a boarding school in Humanthorpe. But the problem is that they don't accommodate them on weekend. These kids have to go back home, which is 80 kilometers from there, every weekend. And those parents can't afford it. Nobody works in that town. There's just nothing going on. So there's another problem there in terms of that, where they're going to have to travel up and down twice a week. And if you've got 2-3 kids, it's going to cost you a couple hundred in a week. Money that they don't actually have.
Jefferson?
Yes.
So that is also one of the problems that we have with the criteria of the scholar transport policy. It uses the term needy learners, right? The new scholar transport policy that was promulgated in 2015. The old one had an abstract or had a number. It said if you travel more than 5 kilometers one way to school, you would be entitled to scholar transport. What it says now is it uses the term needy learners, which can be a good thing because needy learners can be identified in a number of ways. But it's also a very vague term. It's a term not been defined by either the DBE or the Department of Transport. And a learner like that we would argue in a situation like that those learners must get scholar transport, even if it is for that Friday or to the Sunday, because to facilitate access, the state must allow that learner to get to school. And for that learner to get to school the Sunday, to be in school on Monday, obviously would require a state agency, if you are saying that their parents are unable to afford, because those learners have the constitutional right to enjoy education. One of the other problems with the criteria is also, it also says a learner, they will not subsidize a learner that goes past a grade appropriate school. Now, a grade appropriate school, if I walk past a school that's full to capacity, but that's a grade appropriate school, and I go to a school in a neighboring town or a neighboring village, I wouldn't qualify for scholar transport. If I'm in an urban setting, if I live in a township, I'm dependent on a grant, but there is public transport available. The policy says
you will not get solid transport. So all these things that are unclear, that is why I would agree with Treasury's call that there needs to be norms and standards. There needs to be guidelines to this policy. This policy is at the moment just words on paper. It has no practical effect. There is no definite timelines from the Department of Transport or from the DBE. Therefore, proper budgeting cannot happen, and therefore the learners would ultimately, they continue to suffer under the current ineffective regime of providing transport.
Okay. Treasury and FSC, would you like to make comments? I understand there were certain questions that were posed to yourselves as well in the course of the equal education answering the member question.
Thank you very much. We've greeted Lady Schlesterstam. That was the issue that was raised more broadly about the presentation of equal education, and also, you know, the importance of actually underpinning it with the requisite funding. Maybe what would be good to just point out is that government is really aware that this is a priority. And if you look at the budget that's been made available from 2012-2013 to 2015-16, over that period it grew by 17%, which is far in excess of inflation. And even if you include the changes that's been made or the reductions, then it still is set to grow by 16%. But what informed the reduction is, and RDG has also made points, it does not help to put money. Money is not the one that pushes service delivery. It's not money that makes the change, but it's actually the school involved that makes the change. And if you look at the grant spending, it's been at 95%. So the reductions made is to deal with the underspending issue. And again, the point that's been made is what we really need to focus on is improved infrastructure delivery and performance as well. There's another question that was specifically posed to National Treasury, had to do with the norms and standards set by the OCPO, and I see it's not here, but I'll answer. Whether it will have an impact on the division of revenue, and the answer is no. The reason why is, and I'll just quote out of Chapter 6, of the budget review. New procurement statements have been issued in November 2015 to give officials greater flexibility to negotiate lower prices. Provinces have been provided with prototype designs and benchmarking costs for different sizes and types of schools, reducing the scope for architects and engineers to overdesign such facilities. So, to some extent, it's national government setting norms and standards, and in assisting provinces to provide those services, infrastructure rather, at a cheaper price. So it does not impact on the division of revenue, but it does allow a province and enable a province to provide the service in a much more efficient manner. Thanks.
Yes, Christy.
Okay, just a few comments on the question. I'll start with Honorable Majlopa. The issue on the provincial, you are actually very right, and the reason why I'm saying we are reviewing this wage is exactly what you are saying, because what we have observed is that while it might have made sense at the beginning, because this formula was introduced back in 98. Now, at that particular point in time, the numbers that we had that you could rely on the statistics South Africa had at that particular point, you could probably just population numbers. Now, the other issue with regards to this formula was that it was meant to ensure that everybody has access to basic services like your education, your health care, and all of that. And so you would basically want to target people and where they live. So in doing that, there was no account taken of migration, what the impact of migration was. You would have, if you remember, the first formula had a component which was called the backlogs component, which was mainly benefiting those provinces that had homelands incorporated in them to address the infrastructure issues. you come to think of it today, that Petros component was removed around about 2005, 2004, 2005, when we moved Social Security grants to the agency. That Petros component did put in some infrastructure, did not address the challenges that, what's your name, Andy, that Andy is talking about now, of those mass schools or no schools at all in the Eastern Cape, for example. It did not address that. Now, the flip side is like, if it has addressed that, so you now have schools all over where the people were, and then they have moved, because they've moved, some of them to the Western Cape, some of them to Gauteng, and mostly that's where people are moving to. They've moved, and those schools are still there, you employ teachers. It's not easy to move those teachers from there. It's not easy to outlift the school unless it's mobile. I know a school was stolen once in a PE. Unless it's that kind of a school, you're not going to be able to move it. Now, that infrastructure either dies, which means you've wasted money in another world, or you need to find something else to do with it. But if the money has moved with the people, then that must collapse. It's a ruin now. So now what we are trying to say now is, much as we wanted people to access services, if you look at the numbers that SSA publishes, we are, the school enrollment, the actual enrollment exceeds the population of the school age population. So you have a gross enrollment which is higher than your school age population. It means they've even accommodated people that are not even supposed to be at school. So we have done very well in terms of access to education. Healthcare, the numbers are also that people that access. The issue is about the quality now of these services. Now, does allocating money to the person generate the quality that you want? So if people move to Gauteng, they move with the money, is that going to generate the quality that you want in education? Probably not. So we need to rethink the weighting, because population, as I said, accounts for about 97% of your allocation. 97%, that's very high. So you might want to reduce it, say, to about 30% or whatever, and then you put other components. For example, basic services. There's a basic component which basically deals with the population that you have in the province, but there's also the poverty component which will address some of the issues that relate to the roads in the northwest, for example. They have challenges with roads in the northwest. They have challenges with rurality. We still look at them as if like they are not a rural province, but they are quite rural because it's all farms all over the place. So all of those issues are issues that we are dealing with in the current review that we want to do for this year. The issue of demarcation, Honorable Manana, like I said, in the past 2 years we started engaging with the demarcation board. In fact, we signed a memorandum of understanding with the demarcation board to assist them with at least some capacity to assess the economic dimension of the demarcation. So the work basically that they did, when issues started being raised, for example, after the Tshwane merger, that's when we saw that there is definitely a challenge that is happening here. So we started engaging with the board, also with the treasuries and COCTA, just to see how we can actually come into that process to avoid the kind of situation that transpired with the merger of Tshwane with the surrounding area. So the process going forward still has to be refined. It's very nascent. It still needs to be nurtured, because they have a mandate. Part of their mandate is to consult, and so they can consult whoever they want to consult. But if they feel like, no, this is the level of consultation that we want, it's their choice. But we are happy with the current emerging a process that we have tried to put in place to try and address some of these things in advance. Unfortunately, it's not just about that. Some of the challenges that your demarcation process is faced with have completely nothing to do with what the National and Fiscal Commission and even the Treasury does for the types of consultations and engagements. So there are other issues that the board must look at in terms of the law, which are not necessarily financial or fiscal in nature, and those we don't actually interfere with. Now, the other question, it's not a question, Honorable Chairperson, yours is just an expansion of the process that we must have with the equal education. I think that's very welcome. We will deal with that and address that particular matter as well. Now, to respond to you, Angela, on the issue of the ring fencing. Now, we are not saying that you must make it a point that you ring fence. What we are saying is there are perpetual or persistent breaches of some of these agreements and arrangements. You see, National Treasury, in terms of Section 216, can take a very drastic measure, which is the same as the measure that was taken last year with respect to municipalities that were owing ESCOM and water boards. It's not a very good thing to do. It's supposed to be the last resort measure that you resort to, because it's provided for in the Constitution. They can intervene. Provinces, you have Section 100. That's, what happened in Limpopo, we know what happened. You intervene in that particular manner. So you take the executive power and then you push it at this level to intervene to correct that kind of a problem. But all of those interventions require engagement at one level or another with Parliament. They can't be constitutionally valid if Parliament has not been consulted. Now, what we are saying is that when you then take those measures, because they're quite extreme, a process should have taken place where you have actually reached a point where you say, you know what, we have tried everything that we can. Now, in order to deal with this matter, this is the last measure that we resort to, we're going to do this until this municipality or this province or this department is able to do this. This is how we're going to deal with it. It's the last measure that you have to engage in to show that you do have the power to take that kind of a measure. But it's not something that one would encourage, that every time there is a breach, then you must actually do that. It can't be, because then it loses also its effectiveness, because we can adapt to those types of measures. So you don't want to use it too often. But you want to say, for these types of breaches that are material and they are persistent, that's what happened. Now, the Eastern Cape issue, I think because I had to deal with it in a different portfolio committee earlier in the week of this education infrastructure. I'd say that if you look at the decision of revenue, it makes provision, the Act makes provision for that type of a measure to be taken. But that measure is not taken too lightly. You have your EDA monitoring and people must report on progress with this thing, and somebody comes in and says, no, you know, at this rate you'll have a problem dealing with this particular measure. But if you're not putting in place any measures, at the province level you have to be talking to the national department to say we need support, because otherwise we'll have a problem here. If you are not actually taking advantage of those institutions that are in place for you to address those types of challenges, then the end result is that the money has to go somewhere, because there's an opportunity cost to this allocation. So if we allocate them for education or for human settlements, and this province does not use that money for human settlements, but we have national targets for human settlements, and there's a place elsewhere where it's being utilized, it's better to move it to that place where it's going to be absorbed to address your problems in this other place. The challenge is, are you actually addressing the problems that you have? And how are you addressing with them? I think that's where we should actually focus this attention, rather than on, because I think the principle to shift commission support it, and in fact we made that recommendation that you must actually do this, because it's pointless to allocate money that is not going to be spent.
Thank you very much. I look around and I see that everybody is satisfied. Yes, go ahead, Mr.
I just wanted to respond to what you said now. So you were talking about these being drastic interventions, and it's not something one wants to use often because it loses its potency, or people look to it for it to happen all the time. But as the lady from Treasury said, when you look at these types of grants, and the provinces have had more than a decade to build capacity to be able to administer these types of grants and to do these types of things. So there has been Section 100 interventions in Limpopo and in the Eastern Cape. One now has to ask, if the capacity still isn't there, what next? Their parliament, I think, needs to play that sort of that extra oversight role. It cannot be so in a country where the constitution says in any matter that concerns the child, the best interest of the child is paramount, that you take away 530 million for infrastructure that is meant to put learners in a safe and secure environment, and you move it to another area of government, all because government officials don't have the capacity to do it, can't perform. That cannot be an explanation. It must be that there must be drastic intervention to address that issue. And Lisa, I just remember now that you mentioned nutrition and I didn't respond to it. I just wanted to say, on the issue of nutrition, we are aware of it, that in some schools that learners are hungry, and especially with learners having to walk these long distances, what we have found is that the learners come, they are hungry and they are tired. So we have learners who are saying to us that they, for the first couple of periods, they do not pay attention in class because they sleep, they try to recover, because food is only being served at lunchtime. So it's only after lunchtime that they then have the strength to learn again. But what also happens is that when these learners are misidentified, because again the identification lies with the principal or the teacher, a misidentification happens, the learners are not identified that require these nutritious services, those learners are they not fed at school, or there is too little food because the money is not being spent appropriately, and then these learners go without food. So again, it must be that when there is capacity building, that the capacity must be built properly, and if the official doesn't perform, there must be action against the official. You cannot just shift money and say there's no capacity. It must be that the capacity is built. And yes, you don't solve a problem by just throwing money at it, but without money, the problem also won't be solved. If there's no money to build the school and you move it to another line item, the child will remain in a mud school. The child will remain in a school with corrugated iron. So those types of interventions, yes, they are drastic, but if the best interest of the child is made to be paramount, those interventions must be taken, and Parliament must then hold government departments who don't perform, they must hold them to account. Thank you.
Honourable Matlosa.
Thank you, Jay. Just one quick question, just for clarification. Have you presented the same presentation to the Basic Education Department? Because I like what I'm hearing, and I know you guys are passionate about what you do. It's very necessary what you're doing, and I commend you for it. But I think what you're saying should be spread over a wider forum. I just want to know whether you've actually done that, or was there a plan to do it? Thanks.
Thank you for the question. There's always an attempt to present to as many portfolio committees as we can, and unfortunately, throughout the years, this committee has been the only committee that is really open to hear us. As we said before, 2013 and 2015, we presented to this committee. And yes, DBE, we would like to present, we just haven't had the opportunity. And we've written to the chairperson, we've written to the secretary, and haven't been given that opportunity.
And last one.
I just want to know what role and whether you have the capacity to monitor these schools in terms of their quality education. Why I'm saying this particularly that issue with the Mandela Park School. That was a brand new school that was standing there, brand new, not open. I made 20 visits to the Eastern Cape Education and got it open. They wanted a great job, there were not enough learners. Learners were traveling about 40 kilometers. Up now, they are traveling 40 kilometers. In 6 years now, the great jobs are not implemented yet. The school has degenerated into, I don't even want to tell you. But kids are still having to travel from that area, 40 kilometers away for the secondary school, and the primary school in the area is just not performing at all. But one, and secondly, the problem with the control system, for me, I think we've spoken about this before. You know, that school in the area are not being identified as a non-school fee-paying school.
but the learners, they just cannot afford it. The people are not working. So the criteria, again, that we need to look at.
Yes, sir. Just on, I know you're talking about the quintile system, like the gentleman said, this is probably best suited for DB. The quintile system opens up a whole host of other problems that you don't find only in the rural provinces. We have a school in Makassar that 80% of the school is dependent on a social grant, but the school is classified as a quintile 4 school, which is your second highest qualification, all because they sit in the Helderberg Basin, which has your highest number of millionaires in the Cape area. So the quintile system takes into account the type of house you have, all these other things. So the quintile system needs to be changed. To what it needs to be changed, there obviously needs to be engagement on that. When you talk about our ability to monitor these types of schools, equal education, unfortunately, we grow all the time, but we are obviously not, we don't have the reach of a government department to monitor compliance and to monitor implementation of policy. We work in a number of provinces, and the people we mostly rely on for information is learners in those schools, is what equal education term equalizes, learners that identify with equal education. Also, we sometimes get information from the media or from concerned parents, or just from community members who are concerned about what is happening. They may not have a child at that school. So our ability to monitor is hampered in such a way, but as far as possible, we try to partner with organizations or partner with community-based organizations to keep these types of things. Equal Education is also on their website, placed information regarding norms and standards. I think there's an app in development or has been developed that learners can use their cell phones to check whether their school is on the list for certain development and can report it if it's not and it's not happening, or if a school, they think the school needs to be on there but it's not on there. So there are things that we as an organization are trying, but obviously we are also a donor-funded organization. We only can go, only do so much with what we have. And we would welcome the opportunity to speak to the DBE in the parliamentary portfolio committee.
All right. I think some of the questions actually should go back to members of parliament to themselves as people who conduct oversight on the department. I think that the one issue that I think is coming to the fore quite clearly now, which is going to assist as well, is the question of multi-planning, particularly on municipal infrastructure, but I think it's something that can be done as well for school building programs. Because there are certain projects that may not be completed within a couple of months or within a year, and so you need to deal with them. And I'm glad that is coming out, that came out in the minister's budget. DPME also is addressing that issue. And I think all of us will have to look into that with keen eyes, because it then begins to resolve some of the challenges that are being experienced, particularly on infrastructure, including the school building program. So we would have to really follow through on those, all of us as stakeholders interested in all of these activities. I'd like to now close the meeting and this section of the meeting. And want to thank Equal Education National Treasury, FSU Salga. EPO was here as well. Thank you all of you for attendance. Thank you, Advocate Jenkins, for your attendance. Members, you must adopt the spread plan report and minutes, outstanding minutes. Thank you very much.